Welcome to Modern Family Matters, a podcast hosted by Steve Altishan, our Director of Client Partnerships here at Landerholm Family Law. We are devoted to exploring topics within the realm of family law that matter most to you. Our discussions will cover a wide range of both legal and personal issues that encompass family law matters. We strongly believe that life events such as marriages, divorces, remarriages, births, adoptions, children growing up, growing older, illnesses, and deaths do not dissolve a family. Rather, they provide the opportunity to reconfigure and strengthen family dynamics in healthy and positive ways. With expertise from qualified attorneys and professional guests, we hope that our podcast will help provide answers, clarity, and guidance towards a better tomorrow for you and your family. Without further ado, your host, Steve Altishan.
Hi, everyone. I'm Steve Altishan. Thanks for joining us for another broadcast of Modern Family Matters. Today, I have Stephanie Pickard. Stephanie is a financial advisor with Johnstone Financial Advisors, and she's here to discuss financial therapy. What it is, how it works, and who can benefit from it. So, Stephanie, before we start in, can you fill us in a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Hi, Steve. Yeah, let's see. So I studied financial therapy in my master's degree at Kansas State University. It's a fascinating topic, and I love it. And I love applying it to clients and helping clients meet their financial goals with this extra tool that a lot of financial advisors don't have. So it's really great.
Well, let's then just start with the obvious question. You know, what is financial therapy?
Okay. Financial therapy is kind of exactly what it sounds. It's a combination of finance or financial planning and therapy. Within the field, which is an emerging field, there's only been a financial therapy association for about maybe 10 years. And within that, it's about 50-50 split between therapists, to use kind of a broad term, and financial planners. So it kind of gives you an idea that it's really this intertangling in between those two fields that you see where this field emerged. And the idea being that financial planners were finding themselves having difficulty working with their clients to get them over this kind of hump where you're like, why in the world are they not doing what the plan that we came up with? And therapists coming in constantly saying, you know, a lot of my clients, their problems are rooted in money. And so I need to understand more about money. And so you see those kind of that crossover there is where financial therapy emerged.
Sounds sort of like, you know, the poem, the best laid plans of mice and men oft go astray. You know, you can set up a great plan. It can be perfect, but then you gotta make it work.
Right.
So that's kind of, it sounds like what financial therapy is there to do. It's not necessarily to make a plan. It is sort of to implement a plan.
Right. Yeah, it can come into a number of the different steps of financial planning. Another one would be, you know, maybe setting goals where you would have clients that were kind of still creating barriers to even setting financial goals for themselves, you know, such as, you know, they don't think they could ever retire, so they won't set that plan, or, just kind of, you know, almost grim things like, I just don't even think that I'll live that long. I'm going to work forever, type of thing where they just don't want to even get into it. So it could potentially even come in with the goals, but more likely you've set the goals and then now you're finding every 6 months when you're meeting with a client, this is not happening. They're overspending. They're not, you know, it just, things are not matching up with what they're saying to you. And so it's like, well, what's behind that? You know, what's going on?
Huh. So that's where the therapy kind of comes in. And so kind of an odd question. Do you call yourself a therapist or do you call yourself a financial advisor?
I call myself a financial advisor for sure. And I guess you could say, well, how could you call yourself a therapist? You know, if you say, well, I am a financial therapist. Well, The word therapy can get thrown around in a much more informal sense. You know, nobody says, well, a massage therapist isn't a therapist. Well, it's just kind of a different application of the word therapy. However, and most folks, like I said, there's that 50-50 split. Therapists will come into financial therapy as therapists first, and financial planners would come into financial therapy as financial planners first. And whereas if you're kind of, you know, then you kind of bump up into scope, I guess, would be kind of the next thing where either side would need to have a good grasp of when to refer out. So, you know, a financial planner might say, you know, hey, I'm seeing, you know, some real disordered behavior here where I think a therapist might benefit, and they might partner then with that person. And then on the other side, hey, you're getting into some, you know, the side of the a therapist might say, you know, you're getting into some financial questions, you know, you have a lot of tax problems or something that I just don't understand. Well, then they might reach in and partner with a financial planner. So kind of getting into the issues of scope there, where if you're going to dabble in this, anything that's kind of a gray area, you really need to understand what your limits are so that you're absolutely only serving the client and never overreaching beyond what you can do to help.
Well, that makes total sense.
Oh, okay, good.
Total sense. No, I mean, it really does. I mean, it's you're kind of looking at it from two different viewpoints, depending on where your background comes from. And as a financial planner, you're looking at it, how can we solve your financial problem through therapy? Mm-hmm. And that leads to the question, I guess, you know, you had talked a little bit about, well, maybe everyone can a little bit, but basically who's your target benefit client from financial therapy?
I guess a target benefit client would be someone who wants to change, who recognizes that they are having this problem and they want to change, because you really can't treat somebody who doesn't want to go there, if that makes sense. And so you can certainly see clients who you might want to explore something with them, but it's pretty clear. And certainly you'd never want to do something in a way that a client, you know, somehow sneaky, I guess, is a way of putting it. Like, oh, I'm therapizing you. I'm putting that in air quotes, which is obviously not a word, without them knowing it, because goodness, you would completely erode trust by doing anything. And so that's why you want to approach anybody that, you know, I'm always really on the forefront with my clients to say, you know, they kind of joke, oh, my coworkers will joke, oh, you have the therapist in the office, so that's probably a good match. But, you know, you know, it be very clear with them. Hey, I have a background in this, and it's only to your benefit, because you definitely don't want somebody that doesn't want it. So really any client who would be ideal would be somebody that presented themselves as, hey, I have this issue that it's not, you know, coming together for me, and I can't figure out why. And so now I need your help. They're reaching out about it. Oh, you know, and the financial advisor and the client could come to that conclusion together for sure, by doing some light digging to say, hey, you know, this is still not happening. Do you want to like look into the background of this or something? And, you know, they have to be open to it. But I think the ideal client, more than anything, just summed up, is someone that really wants financial therapy.
And what do you normally see as kind of some of the causes that people aren't able to do what they want to do? I mean, you know, fears or anxieties or, you know, relationships they have with other people or money. I mean, what sort of kind of drivers do you see with people coming in?
Sure. Just like you think of with classical therapy, almost in a, you know, silly stereotypical way where somebody goes and sees a therapist and they're saying, tell me about your childhood. That's a lot of what we're doing also here in financial therapy. It's truly believed that most money behaviors are rooted in your family and your experiences with money throughout your life. And so it's just exploring and digging out those various relationships and events so that when you do find that you're behaving in a certain way financially that goes against your best interest, then you have something in your mind that then turns on to say, oh, I've explored this before, and now I understand that that's not my best interest talking. You know, that's my mother talking, who didn't have hers or my best interest in mind, or that's my trauma talking, where this has happened, something similar has happened before, but you know, now I'm going to find a different result. So that's kind of where we're looking into opening up that.
So then, what kind of tools, you know, how do you use financial therapy just in your interactions with your clients?
So a few things with every client, not necessarily ones who have approached about financial therapy or maybe even really need financial therapy, you know, for the most part, they're logically following their financial plan. I kind of like to separate it into a little bit of, I don't know, covert is kind of a, I don't want to say sneaky, but it's less noticeable therapy, which is just really good skills that any therapist or financial planner should have, just really good listening techniques. And within that, observing their behavior, you know, looking for any sort of red flags that, you know, might then lead towards needing some sort of therapy. But within that, then you're also building trust with the relation with the client and the relationship. And then more than anything, just kind of facilitating rather than forcing any sort of change within the client. Those are all things that where you're just kind of doing that within the financial planning relationship. You're essentially just sitting on the same side of the table as the client, you know, always on their side, never against. So that's kind of the for everybody. Then when you go to actually apply, you know, like I was saying before with that ideal client, where they come in and they say, hey, you know, I'm not getting past this thing that's hanging me up, or, you know, you've given me this financial plan and it makes sense, but I can't implement it, something like that, where you're getting into actually applying therapy techniques to that person, because we have decided as it, within our relationship that we are going to do financial therapy together. So those are two different things. And then more specifically, when it applies, because this happens so much, is that it can apply to couples as well, where you might have two clients coming in and they clearly have this conflict between them. So maybe individually they could apply their financial goals, but together they're not able to. And so then applying techniques, therapy techniques to, you know, both of them to explore that relationship, their individual relationships with money, and how those can either support each other or then where they have the conflicts within that. So kind of three different levels, you know, kind of the basically to sum up, just like the applies to everyone, sitting on the same side of the table, really good listening, always in tune with the clients, and then that more overt therapy, yes, we're going to do therapy together.
On the overt therapy to start, It sounds, especially the couples therapy kind of stuff. I mean, this sounds like a lot of stuff that, you know, we as, at Land Home Family Law can see. You know, it's very much the same kind of issues that, you know, divorcing couples kind of come to. It's the two of them have different ideas. They have different concepts about, you know, how they should spend their money. And that's a root in a lot of problems.
Absolutely it is. Yeah.
The other thing, and in the covert that strikes me, is the looking for red flags. Because again, that's what, you know, we do a lot is look for red flags, both in issues with you know, potential couples having trouble, but in with estate planning. You know, there's just, there's lots of, you know, kind of that those red flags. So, you know, what are some of those red flags that, you know, especially what, you know, would kind of talk to, if someone comes in, for instance, and their first 20 minutes, all they're talking about is, which is not totally unusual right now, but, you know, what's happening today, you know, they're afraid to go out of the house. Maybe they've been furloughed, You know, maybe they're afraid their business is going to go under. I mean, these things seem to me to be red flags. But what sort of red flags do you kind of really strike at you?
Oh, sure. I guess a little bit more specifically on red flags as it applies to therapy. It might be as something as simple as probably the most obvious would be, you know, overspending or compulsive buying, something like that, where you're seeing that somebody is really working out of their best interests with their money. On the other side of that might be something like workaholism.
Yeah.
You know, where they really feel like they don't, they can't get under control the idea that they have to keep making more money or they keep working, something along those lines where you can really kind of see something where somebody has really stepped out of the ordinary. Certainly some other things, you could look at, you know, financial abuse could be another big red flag where you're seeing, you know, especially as it applies to couples, like you were talking about, where you only have, sure, it might not be a red flag to have only one member of a couple doing the talking. That isn't necessarily on its own a red flag. But if you're seeing someone who is being completely left out of the conversation, it might be different if they're sitting at the table and they're clearly kind of uninterested, like, ugh, I hate money. Okay, fine. And they're, you know, they've clearly just divided up the labor, you know, and you might still be like, hey, I know you're not interested, but I want you to sit at the table and no one has a problem with that. Yeah, you're probably not really seeing abuse happening here. But, you know, somebody's maybe, you know, like we deal with IRAs all the time. And I always say, you know, the I stands for individual. So that's going to be your own account, not ever a joint account. But you've got someone, one spouse, who is constantly saying, no, 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 I'm the one that manages my spouse's money. And well, it's, you know, it's her money. And yeah. So she should have some say on how it's invested or whatever else. You know, I want to know what her risk tolerance is. And that they're saying, no, we don't, I don't want you to even talk to her about risk because it's all me. Well, goodness, you know, then you might, that'd be a red flag. So within relationships, you know, seeing somebody really left out of the table or left completely away from the table, you know, but really being able to recognize the difference between the two. Because like I said, you certainly get a lot of couples where somebody's just not interested, you know, as long as they're in the conversation sometimes. And then there would be some techniques even there to kind of to go on a little bit of a tangent too, but to kind of address this topic, which I think is important to your listeners, to kind of say, oh, okay, well, you know, you might even say, you know, fib a little bit and say, well, you know, for compliance reasons, I need your phone number to the person who's been clearly left out. And, is this your cell? Oh, okay, great. And then you kind of listen to where they might be available and the other person isn't. And then that's when you give them a call and you say, hey, can I talk to you about your account? You know, oh yeah, I know that he usually talks, but maybe I needed to ask you and I needed to know right now, you know, I mean, there might be some little ways of kind of getting in and getting that person to maybe open up a little bit, as far as their financial situation goes. So yeah, within it's pretty interesting how far it can go, as far as red flags go, because people like to say, you know, oh, money isn't everything. You know, money is not, it's whatever. Which I agree with, sure. But at the same time, money is kind of everything because it's our resource. We don't go out and forage for berries really anymore. We work and we get money to buy those berries. And so it becomes everything to us. And so if you have money problems, then it's everything.
Yeah.
and that's the reason why it is such a problem for people and relationships and everything else.
Oh, that makes so much sense. I mean, money, a lot of people, money's a symbol as much as anything else. It's like it's sure. A status of itself. But
oh, you're getting into what we're getting into a little bit later here.
let's do that. What?
Yeah. Okay.
What are some of the tools?
Perfect segue. Yeah. So the number one kind of big tool with financial therapy is this, it's called the KMSIR, meaning revised, which just stands for the Clonst Money Script Inventory, which is an assessment questionnaire. So something that you can actually give to somebody who they go in and they score the various questions. So it's a whole bunch of different questions. You know, I think that people that have money are terrible, you know, or something like that. I mean, it's not exactly that, but you know, those type of questions, and you score them now off the top of my head, I can't remember, but I think it's between 1 and 5. And this was put together by a guy named Brad Klontz, who's kind of one of the main people in financial therapy. And what that reveals, the answers to those questions, are what this kind of baseline in financial planning called money scripts. And money scripts are, if you think of it, it's like a script, like you're an actor in a play and you've been handed a script. Well, it's the script that you've been handed as an adult on how to deal with money, basically. There are 4 money scripts, and you will kind of not necessarily test at 0 for every single one of them, but you'll probably see some tendencies towards certain scripts. And those scripts are the first one, money avoidance, which is that you avoid taking responsibility for your money. You have a negative view of money. You avoid discussing money. You won't open your bank statements. I just assume it's there. I don't want to deal with it. Money avoidance. That's one. The next one, money worship, which is sort of like money brings you power and happiness. It'll solve all your problems, that type of thing. The next one, as you were saying, money status. So it's kind of like, you know, the guy or the gal that wants to own the best sports car or whatever else because they want to show that I have money. This gives me really good status in the world. Money is status. And the last one being money vigilance, the one that's maybe considered to be the least, I guess, negative, because the idea is that you're financially alert. You're less likely to avoid financial conversations, things like that. You're a saver, but then it can also kind of lead towards some things like workaholism, anxiety around money. You don't have enough money. Things like that. So those are kind of the 4: avoidance, worship, status, vigilance, that you will kind of fall on a scale with this Klontz money script inventory questionnaire. Wow. Which is super interesting. So there is kind of some like science behind, you know, this is like this middle ground between therapy and finance, where they've kind of honed it into, hey, there's these money scripts that we've figured out. And if we can kind of put somebody into a category, then we can start working towards opening them up. So that's kind of one of the tools of financial therapy.
It's funny because you say that and you see that in yourself, you see that in other people, and you know, you get a couple of, one's a money worshiper and one's a money hater.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about red flag.
Absolutely. And you can even have, actually, I'll share, before we had this conversation, I kind of went back, and because I had to, of course, take the KMSI for myself. And I came in, not surprisingly, with being a financial planner, that I'm strong in money vigilance. But then the next one down for me was money avoidance, which seems really conflicting, because one of them is like, I want to talk about money. And the other one is, I don't want to talk about money. Yeah. And so then trying to figure out kind of, disentangling within yourself, why did I kind of test high in those 2 areas? Well, you know, it kind of goes down to there might be some overlap there with some anxieties and things like that, for sure. And so, you know, but it is interesting. But yes, within couples, this is where you can really come out and go, oh, I see. Yeah. And even just in a couple's relationship, that awareness of the other side, I mean, might even be enough to really help with a lot of problems, right? You know, just being like, oh, but you know, she's this way, and okay. You know, and then the other thing being is that the other person isn't necessarily wrong. You know, it's just they're different than you. Oh, yeah. You know?
So what kind of other tools you got?
Okay. Let's see. The other one that, which you and I have talked about a little bit before, the money genogram, which I love, which is basically drawing a family tree. And anybody that's had any like influence on your money life or your money story can go on that tree. So it doesn't have to be, you don't have to necessarily include every aunt and uncle, because maybe you hardly talk to them, but you could, include, you know, a step aunt once removed or something, because they did have a lot of influence on you. And so you can, and what you do is you kind of draw that out, and you're like, you talk about their income, you talk about how they saved, how they retired, whether or not they retired. You could even get into, you know, if they had health issues, you know, anything like that. And it kind of, then you can kind of look to see how these, you know, money behaviors then pass down from generation to generation. If you see that, you know, if you, the idea is hopefully to go up a couple of generations and go, okay, you know, like in my family, there's a lot of union workers. And so it's like, okay. And that's kind of what's interesting to explore. Okay. They were a union worker, retired with a pension. Then the next generation, union worker, retired with a pension. And so you can see where, you know, there's somebody in the next line might think, well, that's the key to success. Right. Whereas you might have another family where they were like, well, they own their own business. And then they own their own business. And then they own their own business. Well, you know, these is like really clear, you know, financial decisions that get passed down from generation to generation. But you might be able to open up for you to say, oh, again, that's what I was talking about before. Like, well, that's not me talking. That's my mom talking. Who's a, you know, to use a stereotype, like she was a shopaholic and now I'm a shopaholic, you know, type of thing. So, right. Yeah. So that's the money genogram. A couple of other ones that are kind of small that I kind of still like. One of them is called, this is a little bit hard on radio to explain, but the Dow Jones exercise, which is you draw plot points on above or below a center line that are positive or negative money experiences in your life. So, you know, your dad lost his job when you were five. Well, that's a low point, and you plant that kind of low. And then, you know, somebody won the lottery, so that was super high or whatever else. And then you kind of go up and down, and it looks a little bit like the Dow Jones. So that's why they call it that. And then you plot those points and you kind of look for trends. And even just the concept of exploring that history and seeing, you know, where various things that had incidents in your life that had a financial impact on you, where those are still influencing you today. I kind of like that one. That's kind of a fun little exercise. And the last one being, well, the last one that I'll get into because there are more, but the last one that I kind of thought would be interesting to explain would be like a life aspirations and authentic goals. And that's just basically like writing out, you know, 20 to 30 really like goals that I want and not holding back anything that I want. I want to move to Tahiti. I want to, you know, own a spaceship, you know, and then honing that in. So at first you start no censoring yourself whatsoever. Then you narrow it down based on how much enthusiasm you have for it. Then you start looking more and more feasible, assigning a dollar amount and then tasks. So then how do I actually concretely get to these things? So kind of to, if that makes sense, just, you know, you start really broad, anything that you possibly want. And then you start in life, anything you possibly want in life. And then you start narrowing it down slowly towards, more and more towards things that are feasible, how much they cost, money-wise, how they'll we'll get there. So does that make sense?
Oh, that makes such sense.
Yeah. So
we had a podcast earlier with Will Jones, who is an attorney at Landerholm, about the divorce process. And very similar. Kind of start out asking for the moon or wanting the moon.
Oh, right.
And then work down toward the realistic, you know, goals and getting to a final settlement. And it's that same sort of concept. I really like that. Hmm. So it sounds like you were kind of talking about, you know, you were taking some of these tests. So why are you practicing on yourself?
Right. Exactly. No, very good. So I think if you, as a financial planner also, I think every financial planner should do a little bit of financial therapy, but especially if you want to apply, especially if you want to be a financial therapist, applying financial therapy to yourself first needs to be the first step. That's for sure. Because you need to understand your own, you as the planner, your money story. Because like I said, you know, I have this like strong tendency towards the money vigilance script. And so sometimes for me, you know, I might see, you know, somebody who's you know, more of a spender or more of whatever, and they're not going outside of their goals whatsoever. It's still within their plan, but I might insert myself in some small way by judging or having some sort of bias or want to push them in some sort of way. No, I need to get myself out of there because it's the client only. I need to focus on the client, not myself. So if you have, you as the advisor, have explored these issues, done some of these exercises yourself, reflected a lot on yourself, then you're going to recognize so much more easily when you're in a relationship with a client to see, oh, here I go. Here's me getting in there. Nope. You need to get yourself out of there because we need to focus completely on the client. So that's kind of why I think that I've done these exercises for myself. And I think that probably every financial advisor should do something or some sort of exploring of their own thoughts and biases.
So then you integrate that into your, you know, financials plan for your
client. Yeah. So the other thing that it kind of goes back to is a little bit of just being able to help them within the financial planning process, using the financial planning process to kind of get around some of these issues that the client may have, such as things like we do, like we would just, you know, on a very regular basis, a very normal thing to do would just be to rebalance their account, rebalance their investments, you know. And the idea being, of course, that you sell high and you buy low, which is counterintuitive to a lot of people, but these are more automatic processes that would come in for a client that would help them stay out of the process a little bit and to help them, you know, stay out of their own way because you are just doing the financial planning and they are not in the way with their own thoughts, biases, whatever. And that's going to be one thing that'll help them move in. The other thing being like, you know, besides rebalancing, like kind of using different buckets, like this is your short-term budget bucket, this is your long-term bucket, whatever that might be, because then you can kind of convince them, okay, well, with this short-term, we're not going to take much risk, and then that's going to open you up to taking much more risk with this more long-term funds that you have set aside for retirement. You know, your short-term, it's sitting in your checking account. We're going to take like no risk. But whereas, you know, this is your IRA that you're not going to use for 30 years. So we're going to take a lot of risk with it. So those kind of basic financial planning techniques and tools obviously will kind of go around anybody's financial thoughts, feelings, biases, and will help them without causing them any issue, without causing them to get in the way, if that makes any sense. So
it makes complete sense. You're putting people back on the rail who got a little bit off, and you're doing it, you know, through looking at them in a little bit of a different light than maybe some other, you know, traditional financial planners were. It's not all just about the numbers. So
right.
It makes complete sense to me. Yeah. Wow, we could talk about this forever.
I know.
We've sort of come to the end of our time, but
yeah.
But thank you, Stephanie. This was really good. I mean, I can certainly see where, you know, not only is this a fascinating subject, but it can be helpful to a lot of people who are struggling to stay on their financial plans for a variety of reasons. And the next time we get together, we are going to talk about the money story because that is fascinating.
Okay. Yeah.
So also though, you know, thanks so much for being here. It's just great. And I want to thank everyone who is listening to this episode of Modern Family Matters. And, you know, and I remind people if who are listening, if you have any family related topics that you'd like us to address, you know, legal or otherwise, or if you're interested in being a guest on our podcast, please feel free to contact me, steve@landerhomelaw.com. So once again, thanks everyone for joining us. And we'll see you next time on Modern Family Matters. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Modern Family Matters, a legal podcast focusing on providing real answers and direction for individuals and families as they navigate the growths, changes, and challenges of creating their new family dynamics. Modern Family Matters is sponsored by Landerhome Family Law, serving Oregon and the Pacific Northwest. and devoted to providing clients with compassionate and fierce legal advocacy with a firm belief in the importance of upholding the family unit amidst complex transitions. If you are in need of legal counsel or have additional questions about a family law matter important to you, you can visit our Landerholm Family Law website at www.landerholmlaw.com or call us at 503-227-0200 to schedule a case evaluation with one of our seasoned attorneys. Modern Family Matters, advocating for your better tomorrow and offering solutions on legal matters important to the modern family.